For today's episode, Nicole Rincon returns to talk about various gastrointestinal related problems, biomarkers, and treatments related to autism. Nicole will take us through a few pre-pregnancy, pregnancy, and for the autistic child to increase our awareness and tools to consider for reducing the rates of autism and for mitigating symptomatic problems with GI and autism. Nicole Rincon is a board-certified physician assistant with over 17 years working in medicine. Currently, Nicole works at the Razignal Medical Center, which includes Drs. Dan Razignal and Richard Fry. With over 17 years in medicine, working with various conditions, and her drive as a mother, Nicole continues to offer tremendous knowledge on the topic of autism and other related conditions. Check out the show notes for more information on Nicole. But for now, an important message about Daylight Computer Company. I would like to take a moment and mention a pressing issue we are seeing in our modern world. And that is tech use and tech light. The data are impressive and concerning on isolated wavelengths of light, especially shorter wavelengths, which is blue light. For those that don't know, we have chromophores, which are special proteins that absorbs specific wavelengths of light. For blue light, the light that is LED light and tech light, that protein is called melanopsin. Melanopsin is responsible for our circadian biology, physiology and cell functioning, hormone regulation, and even a connection to an area huge for mood. A consideration we should include is this protein was not even discovered until 1998. It seems important for us to understand how our biology uses the different wavelengths of light for various aspects of our biology. This blue light chromophore is our master controller, our master clock. Remember, circadian rhythm is a two-part process, two independent parts, light and dark. For a quick reference, see, the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. But for now, I have something exciting. I want to introduce a product unlike any other product available. A highlight is the product from Daylight Computer Company created their product based on these factors. The Daylight Computer is completely blue light free. It has no flicker. Short wavelength flicker is extremely harmful for our eyes and downstream biology. Light flicker is constantly turning our central nervous system on and off. Essentially, it is like going to a light switch and repeatedly turning it on and off. The problem is, blue light and LED light does this. And it is so rapid, you cannot even perceive this in real time. The Daylight Computer is the lowest stimulation and foremost for sensory-sensitive users. It is no question that the alternative product, especially when used at night, do not address or consider this in their product. It is so toxic to human biology. Big tech corporations have patents on how their short wavelength implicate the human nervous system. And a bonus, despite Daylight Computer not having backlight, it is very functional for outdoor use. And of course, increased sunlight is always preferred. I am happy to offer a discount for the Daylight computer. You can use the code AUTISM for a $25 off coupon. Again, use the code AUTISM and the discount code for $25 off. See the link in the show notes to Daylight Computer Company, or just give it a quick search in your internet browser. Use the code AUTISM for $25 off. Nicole, welcome back. I'm so happy that you joined again.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, it's so fun talking to you, on and offline, actually.
Perfect. Well, you can reach out anytime. I'm really, I've been trying to be more active on my ex profile. So, you know, I'm answering a lot of just patient emails, but just, you know, general people inquiries. So if you ever want to, hey, Nicole, what about this? Or what's this study? Or what do you think? Just reach out. I'm there. I'm, what's my handle at Nicole Rincon PA, I believe.
Yeah. So. I put that in the show notes again. And it's a wonderful follow. You're a great follow. You, I have something that from about a month ago that I want to ask you about later on from that you mentioned on X, and it was like, wow. I was hoping that we could start with a pre-pregnancy related to gastrointestinal things that a mother could be on the lookout for as she's going into, let's say, like a planning pregnancy.
Yeah.
And this could be, maybe she has a child with autism already or not. Maybe you can discriminate between that, what that looks like. But are there standard checks related to GI that a mother could look out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think we touched on it in one of our last podcasts. But definitely maternal abnormalities can, you know, contribute. They found that there's a lot of maternal risk factors for autism spectrum in their offspring. And, you know, so I think I mentioned we do this at our office sometimes, like you said, even for pregnant, like people that are high risk, maybe there's a family history of autism or there was a previous child that had autism and they want to try and prevent it. So there is a lot of things we can do and should do prior to, you know, even conception. You know, you mentioned GI. So, I mean, we do, let me start with the blood work first. So we typically do a blood work panel. And I think we did mention that last time. Thyroid is very important. I know we mentioned that. We always look at vitamin D levels, make sure those are between 60 and 80. The standard is like 30 for standard medicine, saying that that's the cutoff. Low. And that's low. I mean, it typically is associated with, you know, higher disease outcomes. So we're looking at, we want to get it. Last time I checked, mine was 83 and I was ecstatic. You know, that's about where I want it to be. So vitamin D3 is important. You know, looking at anemias, making sure that iron is appropriate. So the best way to assess for iron deficiency anemia with iron stores is ferritin. So you normally get a hemoglobin and hematocrit, but then you get the iron levels. Make sure that usually we want those above 50 for most people. So again, the reference range is really, you know, kind of not appropriate if it's, you know, some people say, oh, it's, I think it's 20, depending on the lab, but we try to get it up to 50. We'll look at things like MTHFR genes. So if there's methylation issues, we see that a lot with miscarriages. I know we talked about the folate receptor antibodies. Definitely that is associated with higher miscarriage outcomes. So we want to make sure they're getting good appropriate folate on board. So again, I mentioned it last time, but it's so important. To treat the MTHFR, you might need maybe 1 milligram of methylfolates. But to treat the folate receptor antibodies, there's been a big push on X. Everybody's been talking about it. And it's true. It's a really big breakthrough in research in the past decade. You're going to want to take higher doses of active but not methylated folate, like folinic acid specifically. So we look at that. And we will supplement, you know, put mothers on leucovorin and or methylfolate. We want to look at some mitochondrial dysfunction. If the mother's energy production is low for some reason metabolically, then that can be associated with autism. So we'll look at things like carnitine, which is associated with metabolic mitochondrial dysfunction. Other things, you know, we can look at CoQ10 levels. That can be very important. The other things, you know, obviously the general screenings are going to do liver function, kidney function, you know, diabetes, make sure blood sugar is normal. Western medicine is pretty good about looking at that. Inflammation is big too. So we have the CRP, ESR, you know, these markers are just, they don't obviously indicate where the inflammation is coming from, but if there's an inflammatory condition in the mother, especially like autoimmune disorder type inflammation, like rheumatoid arthritis, that kind of thing, then we should definitely be looking at that. And, you know, ideally, depending on how high the inflammation is and what the kind of the, what the profile looks like, we may want to treat that first. And that doesn't necessarily just mean, okay, let's put them on, you know, Plaquenil or whatever they're going to normally treat autoimmune with, but really trying to look at the root cause. So a lot of what we do in the moms is really like what we're going to do in the kids. And we're just hopefully prepping the mom to avoid the disease in the kid. Because oftentimes you'll find these abnormalities, you know, and you're saying, oh, well, this is a lot of this was genetic, came from the mom. There was toxins passed down, so inflammation passed down, you know, mitochondrial deficits, you know, that kind of thing. So so those are kind of generalized markers that we look at for blood and a stool analysis. Yeah. I mean, if a mom's coming in and she's like, yeah, I've had chronic constipation my whole life. I've had, you know, diarrhea or bloating after every meal, you know, different GI, then definitely the gold standard that we do for just generalized stool analysis is a comprehensive stool analysis, like a CSA, and that's what it's called. And they do, you know, it gives you a comprehensive what's growing in your, really in your lower intestine in the colon. So it'll give you bacteria, fungus, we'll check for parasites. I do find parasites. It's crazy. I mean, you don't think in the Western world, like you read it online, but it really is a thing. And it really does actually even come up on the stool. So checking for that. Inflammation in the gut. So if you're suspecting that there's inflammation for the blood, look at the gut first. You know, you can do it a calprotectin, a zonulin level, looking for a leaky gut. And all these things, like I said, usually come included on the stool analysis. So that's a really big one. And, you know, oftentimes, I think I might've mentioned this last time, let's say that the mom has rheumatoid arthritis and we test her gut and she's got this huge amount of Proteus mirabilis. And it's like, well, that might be coming from the gut. So Proteus mirabilis, overgrowth is associated with rheumatoid arthritis. There's been several studies. You can look at PubMed. And so you really understand that the immune system is usually coming from the gut. So we look there, and so it's really cool. I mean, it's unfortunate, but I mean, it is cool when you find these correlates, like, oh, your symptoms correspond with this test and holy cow, like now we can treat it. So it's one of those awesome aha moments that we do get. I mean, I don't always get it. We hope for it, but, I do sometimes get it. So it's great, that we can do at some, you know, make an actionable plan. And then the other test, a lot of providers talk about it online and I totally agree. There's an organic acid test. It's by, right now, it used to be Great Plains Laboratory. Now it's Mosaic, I believe. We're not affiliated with them in any way, but it is kind of the gold standard for an organic acid test. And that can show very well other chronic infections. So it'll show metabolites of yeast, of other fungus like molds, bacteria, clostridia. It'll give you some mitochondrial inflammation, oxidative stress, vitamins. It's really a comprehensive test. The downside is it's just one snapshot of one urine test. And I mean, that's kind of all tests in general. And sometimes things are missed, but it can really show a good amount of chronic infection sources, you know, between like I said, the fungus and bacteria kind of genre. It's not very good at viruses, but that can be, it can be a big piece. So those are kind of the two GI tests, I would say. You're asking specifically about GI, is the OAT, organic acid test, and the stool test. So super helpful. And you know, that really does give, I mean, if the OAT looks perfect, it's gorgeous, then we're thinking, okay, this is pretty good. But I've seen them in, you know, neurotypical people and they're healthy, they're walking around and their OATs look, you know, pretty bad. Are you having symptoms? Are you having problems sleeping? Are you having joint pain? Oh yeah, my back does hurt a lot. I just thought it was aging, you know? And so there's a lot of symptoms that people just kind of chalk up to, just getting old or whatnot. This is me, you know, and it's really an infection that they didn't know about, or dysbiosis, you know, some kind of abnormal balance. Brian, I can't hear you anymore. I'm not sure if that's.
How about now?
There you are. Perfect. Now I got you.
Yeah, as you were talking though, I was like talking to myself. So maybe that was just it.
Right.
CSA, I put it together. That's comprehensive stool analysis. That's just what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was doing that a lot.
Sorry. No, I'm ever confusing because it's hard, you know, you have the curse of knowledge. So I say these things and think, oh, everybody knows this is standard in my world. But of course, so please ask because, you know.
Yeah. These types of labs are like so new to me.
Right?
Yes. I'm clueless on this. And that's why I want to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
Can we go back to the MTHFR lab? Sure. What is that lab work or what does that draw?
That's a good question. So it's a blood draw. And now it's nice. You can get it through Quest or LabCorp, just your standard blood, you know, stations. And it's one test and it looks for the genetics specifically associated with methylating folate, you know, prior to the methylation cycle. So we there's two gene variants that they look at, C677 and then 1298. And they'll give you basically what genes you have. If you have all four of them as bad genes, like both alleles on both genes, I know that's kind of a lot of genetics, but basically you can have 4 out of 4 of them good, 3 out of 4 of them good, 2 out of 4, 1 out of 4, and then 0 out of 4. Usually anybody that has more than 2 bad, it's not a viable pregnancy. So like most, you won't really find anybody walking around with 3 or more bad alleles in those 2 genes. So because it just won't support life. And, you know, the DNA won't get methylated properly. People won't grow. The development won't happen. So, but it's really important. And I have so many patients. I had one of my best friends. I mean, she was having a lot of, she just had another baby and she was on her, after her 4th pregnancy, super fatigued, not feeling well. And we were just talking and I thought, I asked her, have you tried methylated folate, you know, methyl folate? She's like, what's that? You know? So I gave her, I don't know what I gave her. I think it was 5 milligrams a day. Cause, she wanted to see results and she said it was game changing. She said, this is life changing. I have my energy back. I can take care of my kids. So I, you know, some people, even if, like I said, you're not on the spectrum, you need that support and it really does help. I take it every day, you know? So, and I feel much better. I know when I miss some of my methylated vitamins, I can totally tell. I'm just dragging. My brain's not as sharp. Yeah. I mean, I'm walking around, I'm doing it, but you know, I'm not as clear. So it does matter.
Is that something that's prescribed or can you get that over the counter?
That one you can get over the counter actually. Yeah. You can buy it at any health food store online, you know? It's like I said, it's cheap too. It's not expensive as far as supplements go. So ideally we'd test for the gene and see if you have it and try the supplement. But you know, if you're just on a budget and you're like, I can't afford to do this, you can try it. The on your own. I mean, obviously this is not medical advice. I am not giving you direct medical advice, but, in general, the studies show that the side effects are very low. You know, it's very well tolerated, especially the supplement dose you're going to get over the counter. They do have now some crazy high dose methylfolate, like 15 milligrams. And that's super high. I don't recommend anyone starting there because I do have parents that'll write me and say, hey, we started this and kids bouncing off the wall. And I'm like, no, that's way too high to start. Like that will almost always induce hyperactivity for a kid that's naive to methylfolate, like that hasn't taken it before. So yeah. So just be cautious. This is why I tell people, you know, it is ideal to work with a provider. Cause, you know, parents be like, oh, we tried methylfolate and it was so bad. And it was so bad for us. And I don't know what you're talking about, but it was just the wrong dosing. And you almost always have to titrate it, start low and titrate up. So, yeah.
In my small community, I know someone that tried that and they have an autistic son.
Yeah.
And they said it just didn't work. And I'm wondering if it just wasn't given properly.
Yeah. Well, and the thing with, so like I said, there's the methylation deficits and sometimes you can notice pretty quickly, but if we're dealing with cerebral folate deficiency, it takes a long time. You know, the blood-brain barrier has to shuttle in this folate. And it's kind of an active process. It's not a passive one. So it's not just kind of diffusing like osmosis, you know, it's not just traveling. So it has to be shuttled in. So we find that it can take months. I mean, I have patients that don't, you know, 3 months, 6 months. Usually I will say we do it for, you know, the high dose folate, leucovorin for 6 months. So before we're going to say, did it work or not? And if you look at, and you know, the number one thing I look at usually is cognition. I try to find, I mean, there's speech. Speech is a good marker because you can say, hey, you know, how many words was he saying? Oh, he was saying one word sentences or two, and now he's on to three. And that's a good sign, right? Anything, so we try to quantify it just so that we know if it's working. But also cognition. How's he doing in school? How are his grades? Is he learning something new now? I know with my son, we've been bumping up the doses of his leucovorin, and I'm floored. We'd stopped it for a couple of years. Cause I've been doing this, you know, for my own triplets and my two boys with autism for a decade. But I stopped it for a couple of years thinking, well, you know, it's hard. It's a marathon. So we just stopped it because it was expensive and, we didn't have insurance coverage for it at the time. And then we restarted it, and he went from struggling and, you know, barely making grades and kind of a gen ed special ed kind of setting to now he's in full gen ed and he's getting straight A's. And I maybe it's the leucovorin, maybe it's not, I don't know, but it was a big dramatic change. And even his teachers are pulling me aside, like, what's this kid's really, what happened? Like, he's like the last year. And I'm like, oh, well, we started leucovorin a year ago again. So, you know, I am a huge fan, and I see it in other patients too. It's not just my story. So, like I said, it's been really popular online. Everybody's been sharing these stories. I think because Dr. Fry, you saw that article, he was on CBS, I think. And so now it's just crazy because everybody's like, what is this antibody and how do we treat it? Nobody knew about it. And I love that. I love it because, you know, that there's this idea that we're finally getting to some root causes. There's an antibody that prevents folate from getting into the brain. It doesn't grow properly. It makes sense. It makes sense from a developmental standpoint. And it helps. I mean, I at the TACA conference, there was a big meta-analysis, and it, every time there's been a couple now, and they're statistically significant. I mean, it does show that it helps in double-blind placebo trials. So, you know, it's not just hearsay and anecdotal stories. So, it's pretty cool stuff. And again, it's wrapping it around a pregnancy. You can give it to mothers too. You know, I have it. So, you know, maybe that was part of my issue. I don't know if I had it during my pregnancy. I mean, we didn't even know about it back when I was pregnant, but, I wish I had, but I take it now, you know, and, yeah, I mean, it's helped me a lot, you know, so.
Seems like from the mother, it could help her develop the placenta is what I'm thinking. I don't know, but. Because she has a vital role with the placenta.
Yeah. I mean, it's critical. I mean, the studies have shown that the developmental changes that they've found in utero seem to happen, that early development, that first trimester. So obviously placenta develops within the first few weeks of pregnancy. But yeah, that first 12 weeks, you know, the first trimester is usually the first 12, 13 weeks. So yeah, makes sense. But yeah.
Yeah, and speech communication is a big improvement. And I was thinking about the Kanner papers, the initial Kanner paper. He had three nonverbals in there.
Yeah.
Richard, Herbert, and Virginia. And two of them at the time of the publishing were beginning to talk.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that, what this folinic acid is doing is like helping the connections like between Wernicke and Broca, just helping out the connections there with these.
Yeah.
Distal connect areas.
Yeah.
This is what I was imagining.
Yeah. I mean, connectivity in the brain is huge, and you have to have growth. I mean, DNA replication and growth. Yeah. I mean, just the simple, like, you know, terms that we learned in biology, you know, I mean, it drives the whole process. And so, like I said, when you have more connectivity, you're going to be less focused on one particular area of your brain, you know, you know, it's hard. It's hard with autism. I mean, we'll get to this later, but I did want to bring up those telepathy tapes because it yeah. brings up a whole, I mean, it blew my mind when I listened to it, and I'm kind of half obsessed with it because, you know, as my scientist brain, I'm starting thinking, okay, so maybe it is the connectivity. Maybe they don't have as much connectivity. Maybe there's certain areas of the brain that are more active than a typical mm-hmm. brain that's working all together. And so maybe they do, that's part of the, you know, part of the, savant-ish skills. You know, I have so many kind of quack theories on my own that I just sit mm-hmm. at night at 2 a.m. and come up with, that I'd love to test, but I don't, obviously we don't know. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, it's hooey and it's not real. And, You know, and I understand skepticism. It's healthy to have skepticism, you know, but I love doing the opposite. I'm like, well, what if it's true? I mean, we don't know it's true, but let's assume it's true. It's a science, right? And then take that hypothesis further. What would that mean? What would that look like? How would that happen? Yeah. So anyway.
There's been independent studies on telepathy outside of autism and nonverbals.
Yes. And
significant papers too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. So Kay was on Joe Rogan recently and they talked about
how it's Kai. Yeah.
Kai.
Kai, yeah. Stuff, you know.
Science, they don't like whenever their capacity to think are questioned, you know, they don't want to be proven wrong and so forth. So it's kind of a tough arena to get into.
It is tough. And I think, unfortunately, or fortunately, that's where the money's made, right? I mean, it's people that are thinking outside the box that are, you know, that are questioning, why is this, what is this? And that's where the breakthroughs are happening. It's not like, well, yes, this is what we know, and we're just going to go down the same road. I mean, you know, yeah. If it's working, it's working. But in the case of autism, I mean, the rates are increasing. And, you know, I mean, my kids tell me, you know, like, yeah, there's a lot of kids. I mean, there's one in my kids' classrooms, there's one in 20 kids, you know, one every kid, there's at least a kid with, you know, autism in each classroom. So, you know, and yeah. And so that's why I'm here. What are we going to do? What are we doing about it? You know, let's do something.
It's like we're
something meaningful.
Delaying. Like there's a delay or response, you know.
Right.
But it sounds like what you described so far is like the pre-pregnancy into the pregnancy is kind of the same thing. It's just different time points.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, I, you know, like for example, with the dysbiosis, and I think about PCOS is in maternal PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is correlated with autism and offspring. I think it's like, I don't know, there was a study that was like, it was four times more likely, you know, if to have a child with autism. And so, you know, the question is, okay, so what causes PCOS? And that's typically a dysbiosis, and there's hormonal involvement. And so what are the hormones involved, you know, and then that seems to pass on to children as well, as far as, you know, there's, kind of relating, correlating back to your cholesterol. I know where you're going with this, is that, you know, there's a lot of hormonal abnormalities in kids with autism. And I see it. I see that, you know, there's kids with high testosterone. I see a lot of kids with excess estrogen, a lot of cortisol deficiency. And then we also see hypo cholesterol, you know, emia, like low cholesterol. And we see that, I see it pretty frequently. I mean, to the point where it's maybe, I don't know, I would guess 1 in 4, 5, where it's lower than the threshold that we talk about. And so sometimes you'll see that in the moms, like low cholesterol in moms can be associated with lower cholesterol in the children, which can lead to impaired brain development as well. You know? So hormones are a big deal to check as well.
Yeah. Is that the total cholesterol, or what on the, like the lipid panel is it specifically?
Yeah. So what we obviously cholesterol is its own kind of functional medicine specialty, and you can go really in depth with adults. And I've listened to talks with, by Peter Tia and things that he really gets into it. I love him, but, just for our purposes and from what we try to base it off of the literature specifically with autism. So we look at total cholesterol. Most of the studies look at total cholesterol. And so that's what we base it off of. We don't usually get, at least in the younger kids, a full lipid profile. We just get the total. Okay. And in our practice, I mean, we typically treat when it's less than 145. And I mean, it's crazy because, you know, like I said, there is a subpopulation of kids with autism that have this low cholesterol, and you can see it very frequently. I mean, in the mood disorders, you know, the kids will be very grumpy. They will usually be very irritable, moody, up and down mood swings. You know, they feel very emotionally dysregulated, and aggression, you know, we'll see it. And even, you know, cognition, but cognition can be tricky. But when I see a moody child, I'm like, let's check cholesterol. You know, it's one of the things we look at. And, you know, what's going on there? You know, because, I mean, cholesterol is such a tricky it's such a tricky topic because it's been kind of Western medicinized for so long, and we think it's the devil, and we're like, this is just cholesterol's clogging arteries and causing death. And I mean, it is an absolute essential nutrient for brain growth. I mean, it myelinates the nerves. It causes, you know, cell, you know, transmission, communication. I mean, there's a lot going on with fat, you know, with healthy fat, with cholesterol. And so, yeah, I mean, and then we know this, and even in generalized medicine, you could do a PubMed search, and it's associated with other neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. If you do a PubMed search, like, you know, low cholesterol, there's several studies that say low cholesterol causes Parkinson's or is contributed to, you know, with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. So I think it's important that we really question, like, well, where does it need to be? You know, I mean, it's low definitely seems to be bad. I mean, at a certain point now, you know, do I let, I mean, kids run around with a total cholesterol 300? I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, I think at a certain point we need to look at both ends of the spectrum. But you know, there is a point, I think, where too low is dangerous, and we see it in our kids, you know, and we treat it. It's actually really cool. I mean, there is a supplement, it's called Sonic Cholesterol, and it's actually cholesterol capsules. I mean, we, ironically, everybody's trying to lower cholesterol, and we actually, we prescribe cholesterol to some our kids if they're low on labs. And it helps. It helps, like, sometimes stabilize mood. And it helps with sometimes attention, sometimes cognition. You know, and of course, too, we try to treat with food. Usually one of those capsules is equivalent to about the amount of cholesterol in one egg. So if the child's not allergic to eggs, then I'll say, hey, let's get some free range, you know, organic eggs and try to do two of them a day. It's usually where we kind of start, but obviously depending on the child and what they need. But it is, it's true in mothers too. So looking at cholesterol, I think, you know, I just saw, and I can't quote this, I just saw it on X, and somebody had posted this small little abstract, but they had an odds ratio of disease development, and they actually found that, like, the optimal cholesterol level, total cholesterol, to decrease overall mortality was 220, was around the optimal range. And that when it got below, like, 160, they found that the disease ratio went up. And then when it got above, like, 280, the disease ratio also went up. So it was kind of this bull curve of, like, you know, cholesterol, like, around 200 or 220, even higher, seems to be really protective of the body and the brain. And, yeah, particularly the brain. But it is responsible for hormone production. So you need it to make cortisol and to buffer you from stress.
Yeah, that's what I had bookmarked for later because...
I know, I'm sorry. I kind of jumped into it, but it was relating to hormones.
So. Yeah, you're fine. I'm glad we got to talk about it because whenever I saw that post on X, I was like, whoa, I've never considered that.
Yeah.
Low cholesterol and this correlating with these problems.
Yeah. Well, just as a personal story, I mean, I can share. I've always had, my family, we have high cholesterol, like the hyperfamilial cholesterol. And I, you know, it's always been a little high. I don't know, like 220, maybe 230, you know, it's been always a little over 200. And my doctor's like, even when I was like 19, you know, and my doctor's like, that's kind of weird. You're kind of young for that. Cause I've never been terribly overweight. When I got married and we had our wedding in Cancun, I did what all women do. You know, I lost all this weight and I went on this ultra low calorie, low fat diet. And I lost a bunch of weight. And, I don't know. I think I got my BMI down to like 20 or something. And I remember my doctor tested my cholesterol and he's like, oh, wow, this is the first time your cholesterol has been normal. Like, congratulations. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's great. But I haven't menstruated in over a year. And he's like, what? So I know it's a little personal, but I actually stopped when my cholesterol got normal. My hormones shut down and I just stopped menstruating. Like, for my body, getting to that lean body mass, BMI of 20, 21, getting my cholesterol normal, my hormones shut down. And they even did like a progesterone challenge test for me. Like, well, maybe you need progesterone, but not estrogen. And I failed it. He's like, you don't even have any hormones. Like, you don't have enough estrogen or progesterone. And he was kind of baffled. I remember he was sitting there and I'm like, I don't know, but my body just knows. And I wasn't eating enough. And as soon as I started eating more and going back on a normal diet, I started menstruating again and everything was in, and then my cholesterol went back up to 230 and he's like, well, here you are again. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, so I just, it was a lesson for me. Like, I have to listen to my body. My body, you know, is telling me. And, you know, and I remember back then too, you know, and there was probably my thyroid wasn't happy with me either. I mean, I was cold. I was a little more fatigued. I wasn't as like energetic. And I'm like, oh shoot. Like I kind of dumped that cholesterol paradigm just off of my own personal story a while ago. Like, cause they, you know, and my family's like that too. Like they all kind of have it. And so maybe it's buffering toxins. Maybe I need more for my cortisol because I'm a high energy person. You know, I mean, maybe, you know, I don't know. I mean, I could make theories, but my whole point is, yeah, cholesterol is definitely not the devil. You definitely need it, you know, and we don't need to lower everybody as low as we can get to make the, that's, it's not, I don't think that's a picture of health. You know, yeah, I don't think that's what health looks like.
The ranges are pretty suspicious, I think. Maybe I shouldn't say suspicious. It's just very questionable.
Yeah.
Like the new ranges.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty aggressive. You know, when I have done primary care, I try to just be reasonable. You know, like you said, there is a point where I think you should treat, and you know, if it's getting up to 300 and there's risk factors and things, it can, okay, let's look at this. But yeah, I mean, some of the recommendations are pretty low for people if post-stroke or heart attack, it's, you know, they're getting their total cholesterol really low. So
yeah,
makes me worry.
Yeah. Yeah. And just it's sulfating with vitamin D. I mean, it's optimal. That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
That's what it's supposed to be doing. The 7-DHC, yeah. I think. 7-DHC, yeah. And the vitamin D.
I like my hormones. I mean, we need hormones. Yeah, I like my cortisol and my estrogen and progesterone and testosterone and vitamin D and all, you know, yeah. I mean, it's all good. It's all good. We need it. I'll take it.
What are some of the symptoms of dysbiosis? Could you explain that to me? Like,
yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, and we see it like most kids have some form of dysbiosis. And what does that mean? I mean, it's this kind of weird word. It just basically means something is kind of atypical or off about the microbiome. So it's a blanket all term, but, you know, studies have shown, like, so autism is interesting. It has its own kind of metabolic profile in the gut, like this own microbiome profile. So they find that what they can almost look at neurotypical kids and then look at their microbiome and look at autistic kids. And there's a different, they can see the difference even just by looking at this little fingerprint of bacteria. And there's several key things that are different. A lot of studies, there's been several that have shown that it's kind of very in-depth in microbiology, but there's something called Firmicutes and then Bacteroides. And these are kind of larger groups, larger genre of bacteria. And most people in the Western world have more Firmicutes than they do is Bacteroides. And that's actually in general buffers for carbohydrate metabolism. It buffers, it's more anti-inflammatory in general. But with autism, there's this skewed ratio of having this increased Bacteroides. And so there's a lot of theories, and it all is, from what I have understood, just theories at this point. Maybe they don't digest carbohydrates as well, or maybe, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe this is what inflammation does. I mean, I haven't read anything that we know what the root cause is, but there is, seems to be a fingerprint. And so what we find is that there's a lot of overgrowth of these pathogenic bacteria at a much greater rate than a neurotypical child. So, you know, you'll have oftentimes these bad Clostridia, like C. diff, Clostridia difficile overgrowth. And so you asked to your point, like symptoms you might find. And usually, again, with a lot of bacterial overgrowth, I'll find diarrhea, you know, I mean, but, you know, any kind of floating stools, malabsorption, like, so you see actual, like, maldigestion. So you'll see food in the toilet, you know, in the stool. You'll see a lot of bloating. Bloating is probably the number one symptom I see. In young kids, you won't necessarily know, because sometimes little kids kind of have a little belly anyway, right? But kids that are what they call posturing. So if they're leaning over a table, and I can't show you here on the video, but just kind of like pressing on things, like they'll usually go to the corner of a table and push their belly on it, and they're kind of scrunched up. Or just curling up in a ball, like they'll often be pressing on it. And not usually with their hands, ironically. I don't know why. They're usually pressing on it with an outside object, like the like a couch arm or something. And they'll lean on it. And so that's kind of a symptom of bloating dysbiosis. And you can see that even in little babies, when a symptom is that the babies will be in that fetal position, they'll be on their they'll be kneeling with, like I said, their knees on the ground, and they'll kind of be like this, and their butt's in the air. If you've ever seen how they kind of push, they kind of scrunch up and have their butt in the air. And that's kind of a sign of fetal bloating and digestion, even, you know, under kids under 1 year old. And so, and obviously gas is big with, you know, you'll have the gas, the bloating, the burping, in a young baby, a lot of reflux. And nose readings are, I mean, they happen on occasion and we all get those, but, if it's a chronic daily thing, then you need to check it out, you know? Yeah. So but yeah, in adults, yeah, it can be any of those. Yeah.
Yeah. For children, I had a question about, how do you get the child, especially an autistic child, even nonverbal? How do you get them to convey what is actually going on with some of these symptoms?
It's hard. It's hard. And, you know, that is a big complaint I hear all the time of parents. Like, how do I know? And you don't always know. I mean, again, there's the pressing on the belly. There's frequent gas. But I'm always assuming, you know, when I hear of a lot of self-injurious behaviors, we usually test the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, and personally, like I said, with my son, you know, at the time he was 2 and he regressed, and I know it was his stool totally regressed with him. I mean, he was having fairly regular bowel movements, and then it started to get mushy and then, you know, smelly, and then he was smearing it, and he stopped talking, and then he was smearing it all over the wall, like he, and you could tell it bothered him because he would just reach in and be like, he wanted it off of him, you know, and then he just, then it was gross, and he just was, it was bothering him. He was always having his hands in his pants, and so I, you know, I just kind of knew, okay, this isn't normal. Like, he regressed, but his stool also regressed, and, you know, I had to treat that, and we had to do something because it seemed he didn't really want to eat. He started you know, refusing food that he had normally eaten. So again, picky eaters is another big sign. If they're not wanting to eat, you know, food aversions, I'm thinking, okay, what's going on in there? And so there's a lot of reasons. I mean, anything, whether they're not, you know, their stool's abnormal, they're not eating, but yeah. Oh, and so my point was, the self-injurious behaviors, part of it, when he regressed, he would just start hitting his head against the wall. Mm-hmm. And this was out of nowhere. And I just would see him and he'd just be banging it. And I mean, as a mother, you're like, holy, what do I do? Like, you know, it's so distressing. But I just had this sense that intuitively that he was in pain. It looks like pain. Is there something bothering him? You know? So, when you think pain, you know, I always think first the gut, you know, like something's going on there. So yeah, self-injurious, definitely. We look at that. And it can be hard. It's very hard. Some of these kids, you know, it's hard to treat. You know, it's hard to figure out, you know, because there's different kinds of dysbiosis. Like I said, there's some kinds of bacterial overgrowth and there's fungal overgrowth or both. And then they'll have, you know, C. diff on top of it. And, you know, it can be very complicated. But, you know, we have to try and piece it apart. I mean, it's, in my opinion, I'm very aggressive with the gut because I think just in testing and treatment, because it's like, if you leave it, it's not usually, I mean, sometimes it gets better. If there was a, like, say they get a virus, like my kids, like they got the flu a few weeks ago and, you know, they didn't want to eat and they kind of vomited a few times. But, you know, now that they're better, it seems to be getting better. But, it, you know, if it's a chronic issue, then you have to address it. Otherwise it won't resolve on its own, or it may not. Sometimes it does, but it may not.
Yeah. Gastrointestinal problems, is there's like three comorbid problems that are so common with autism, and gastrointestinal is one of those. So every autistic child or even adult will have gastrointestinal problems.
Yeah. And I mean, the first thing that we do when I see patients is I ask them, how are you pooping? And almost all of them are constipated, not all, but maybe 3/4, maybe 2/3. So, you know, getting the bowel movement is key to getting things started, to just, you know, removing toxins. These kids, either from the inflammation in their gut or the mitochondrial dysfunction, or just, you know, not enough good bacteria. You know, sometimes the gut will just shut down. It just stops moving. The peristalsis, it slows down. And that's when they get really sick, because they're not digesting. They're not kicking out toxins. You know, the body's meant to poop every day. And if it's not, they don't feel well, you know? So, it's like the first thing we talk about at a visit, like, how is he pooping? Because it is just that important. Like GI is it's hard to recover a child, or make a lot of improvement if you're not working on the gut.
Yeah.
Alongside other issues.
It's so fascinating how that just correlates there. And I think vitamin D is involved, if I had to guess.
It's a factor.
Yeah, because the vitamin D, it provides us a cage on our surface. That way all of our electrical processes on our insides can run optimally. And I think it's a big problem here. Just like the energy is not being, I don't know, it's just not working because of the low vitamin D. Have you ever seen someone with autism with normal vitamin D?
Yes. I mean, have I ever? Yes. It's not common. It's not common. I mean, almost all of our patients are on vitamin D. I mean, I would say 90% of them. I mean, it's highly correlated with low vitamin D. It's one of the supplements that I've given my kids and I've taken, and pretty much everybody is, because it seems to be, you're right. I mean, it is are we not getting enough sunlight? Is it an inflammatory process? Is there not enough hormones, cholesterol? I mean, I don't know. You know, it seems to be that is not autism specific. I mean, I think that most people I find are vitamin D deficient, even in a primary care setting. So do I see kids, like when I say that they're normal, like we'll test them and their vitamin D might be 35, you know, or 40. But we still put them on it because we want to get them in that optimal range. So, but I mean, I've seen kids with vitamin D of like 2. I mean, I've seen it like, holy cow, like you have no vitamin D. You know, and it helps. I mean, there's studies that show that vitamin D just in and of itself as a supplement improves overall autistic symptoms. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I try and get my kids out. I try and get sunlight. I think I'm huge into this. I can tell when my daughter's low. She has, you know, they have like this kind of a grayish tinge. It's like this kind of transparent, kind of sallow. And I'm like, oh no, we need vitamin D and sunlight. And, you know, so I start getting on them, you know, and you can see it in other people. It's kind of this pale transparency of their skin. And that's, when I see that, I'm like, okay, that's either zinc deficiency or vitamin D or probably both. But you know,
a lot of children with autism, they're very, very pale.
Yes.
It's unbelievable. Once you see it, it's like every one of them. It's so powerful. But I want to ask you about the vitamin D supplementation.
Yeah.
What kind of doses are you doing? And are you using anything like K2 or magnesium alongside with it? So it kind of synthesizes correctly? And how long does it take for you to see results?
Yeah. So I, you know, depending, but I do like to recommend vitamin D3 with K2. Usually in most kids, I'll start at, you know, around 2000, I use a day of the vitamin D3. Different brands, I think, have different potencies, and I like the ones that are fat soluble. So the ones that are actually, you know, either as a liquid dropper or in a fat, you know, capsule, like those gel caps, it seems to be better absorbed, and it seems to raise the levels higher. So quicker. So if we're trying to get them higher, then I'll put, you know, and quickly I'll put them on a liquid drop. I mean, it can work fairly quickly within weeks if, you know, if you're using the right product. I mean, if you're taking it for 3 to 6 months and it's not increasing, you're on the wrong product, in my opinion.
Is it just a matter of brand? Is it like the folinic acid where, well, not necessarily folinic acid, but with the folate where there's various options? Is vitamin D the same? Like,
I mean, no, I would attribute most of that to production quality and actually the standardization of supplements is pretty much non-existent. So, you know, you don't really, it's the Wild West. I tell everybody, like, you don't really know what you're getting. And so that's the scariest part, I think, about supplementation. So, you know, I try to use, I buy all my stuff on, you know, FullScript, and they have, they're supposed to have had, if you believe them, third party verification where they do verify their products or some of their products to actually have what they say contains in it. Because the FDA doesn't do that in the United States. So I think that's mostly it. It's like, just because it says it's in there, it doesn't mean it's in there. I mean, you can look at some of these, like I used to look, I think it's closed now. I looked recently, but there was a website called Labdoor, and they would review common supplements for actually what was in them. And I used to spend a lot of time on there, just and a lot of things like those Centrum, you know, one a day. I mean, it has nothing in it. It's just like magnesium stearate. It's just filler. And you read the actual analysis from the labs, you're like, holy cow, they're just selling sugar pills and people buy them. And it's really sad. So, you know, so I think it's just the quality. So if they're taking something and it's not working, let's switch the brand. And, you know, there are some good ones out there.
And people should stay away from proprietary blends. Whenever there's like a couple of different ingredients listed and it says like 5 grams, but there's like 6-8 ingredients listed. You don't have, you have no idea how much of each ingredient is making up that 5 grams.
Correct. I don't buy anything with the proprietary blend. Yeah. I don't at all. I'm like, no, you either tell me what I'm taking or I'm not taking it.
They're so
I want to know exactly what I'm taking. Yeah. Thank you.
Just abbreviate the crucial things and, you know, the filler, like you said.
Right. Right. So you got to be careful. You do have to be careful. But I did actually, and I did want to bring up something that has been on the dysbiosis and the gut topic that's been going around a lot online. And I just wanted to talk about is, you know, the fungal overgrowth is a big deal. And a lot of people are sharing these studies of itraconazole, like curing a kid with autism.
I've seen
that. And everybody was commenting, this was a few weeks ago, everybody was commenting on it, sharing it. And I was trying to kind of jump in there and contribute. And I do see, and so let me start. I normally test for most of my fungal markers with an oat test, like we talked about earlier. If I see more than like one marker, so arabinose is typically, there's a marker on there called arabinose. It's typically associated with candida, or just regular yeast. But a lot of the other ones on there are like mold byproducts. They're like aspergillus or, you know, fusarium, different kinds of mold byproducts. So you want to treat those when you see them. And so I do treat that. And there are different, and it is, I think, important. And with my own kids, I saw, I think I told you last time, I think part of their regression was, it was multifactorial, but there was definitely mold in our house because we were remediating it improperly. We had a leak and blah, blah, blah. And so, and I think they got really toxic from fungus. And so I had to do, you know, clean out, but we ended up back then, I didn't know what to do. I was poring over trials. We ended up doing grapefruit seed extract. Cause I was like, I wasn't doing this yet. I wasn't in the functional medicine space. And it really helped. Like it actually helped. And I don't think it's the cure all for everybody, but I know when I treated the yeast at my kids at that age, treating the fungus, they calmed way down. The behaviors went way down. Just the repetitive, you know, stimming and the self-injurious stuff. I mean, and we didn't end up going on itraconazole, but we ended up on nystatin, which is an antifungal that really just stays in the gut. And it's better for yeast than it is. It's not as broad spectrum as some of the other antifungals like itraconazole. But we were on it for like 2 years, and I couldn't get my kids off. I'd stop the nystatin, and then the behaviors would come back, and then they'd start spinning in circles and running around the house, you know, screaming. And then I'd go back on the nystatin, and then they just sit there and happy, you know, like just calm. So, I mean, we were on it forever. And so it happened. And I have patients like that. So I want to encourage parents. Like, I don't think that study is rare. I think that a lot of kids do have fungal overgrowth specifically. I think mycotoxins are a big deal. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's really treating autism in a functional medicine space, you know, needs to look at fungus and like how to get rid of it, you know, and it's not always killing it. It's not always like, oh, you need this high dose antifungal forever. A lot of it's, you know, kind of detoxing, you know, moving out of the mold, remediating your house, you know, eating, going on a low mycotoxin diet, you know, like not eating moldy foods like bread and juice and things. I usually put kids on a short course of binders. I'm a big fan of binders, like not forever, but a lot of them, they can't always process these mycotoxins. And so they'll just keep recycling them in their body. And then their toxic burden just gets to a threshold that they start regressing and breaking down. I mean, I think that's what kind of happened in my household.
What are binders?
So yeah, binders can be helpful to get rid of some of the toxins.
What are those?
What?
Binders.
Oh, it's a good question. So they're insoluble, basically they're products that don't get absorbed into the bloodstream. So the most classic example would be activated charcoal. So charcoal would be a binder, right? So if you, in Western medicine, like if you overdose on certain poisons, right, they'll give you activated charcoal, even in the ER. Like if you're past the vomiting stage, like sometimes they'll try to like induce you to vomit, but if it's been too long since the ingestion, they'll actually give you activated charcoal. Let's say you drink, like, I'm not good at my ER medicine anymore, but I know that there are certain toxins that have an affinity for charcoal. So they'll basically, we've been doing this in Western medicine for a while. And so they'll bind it and then you'll just poop it out. You don't absorb it in your GI tract and then it comes out in your stool. And so you can rid your body of GI toxins. And so this is really, really helpful for kids with really different kinds of toxicities. It's good for mycotoxins. It's good for even metals. I mean, this is why everybody online is talking about zeolite. Well, zeolite's a binder. And it's a pretty potent binder, especially, I mean, if you get the right brand, and especially for metals, you know, but it can actually, zeolite binds a lot of mycotoxins as well. So I do like to do a trial, and some parents say that it was better. I mean, I have parents, you know, that say, hey, yeah, when he's on this binder, like he's got better eye contact, he's more focused, he's calmer, you know. And so, like I said, that's kind of part of the treatment protocol if you're dealing with a dysbiosis, in my opinion. But you definitely don't want to ever give it without starting to move the bowels first. So basically if the child is constipated, don't give a binder because it makes constipation worse. And then it'll just sit there, this big ball of whatever you're giving, zeolite, charcoal, bentonite clay, you know, there's different ones. You don't want to do it until they're having daily bowel movements. So that's my big warning to parents. You know, make sure if you're going to give your kids any kind of binders, have daily bowel movements first.
That makes sense.
Because it's popular online. Everybody's buying them. Everybody's trying them. And I'm all for, you know, power to parents and, you know, self-advocacy, you know, for your kids. But yeah, you got to make sure that you're not making them sicker. Cause they haven't pooped in like, I've had parents that are like, oh yeah, he hasn't pooped in 5 days and we're giving zeolite. And I'm like, nah, you can't do that. Like stop, you know, usually we recommend some kind of magnesium, in high dose at night to get the bowel movement that works the best. There's magnesium citrate, there's magnesium, oxide ozonated in the form of like, it's called oxy powder. That's my favorite, but, you can do high dose vitamin C. I have, you know, there's obviously the Senecots and things like that are stimulant laxatives. But yeah, get the bowels moving first before you do binders. So I'll say it three times because I've just heard, you know, I've heard a lot of parents with issues. And again, it's like, it's not the binder's fault. It's not that it's the wrong treatment. It's just without the knowledge of knowing how to implement it.
Yeah, that's valuable. And good for whoever named the binders, because it's just binding.
Right.
Names can be complicated. And this one makes sense.
I think it's a colloquial term. I mean, I don't think it's actually like an official term. I don't even know. But it's just everybody uses it, so we all just kind of use it. And I have a couple that are my favorite. You know, that are, some are more gentle than others. Like charcoal's pretty harsh. Charcoal's very, like, it's very nauseating. And it can be more constipating than other ones. So, but you know.
Aggressive.
Yeah. So anyway, treating the mold, binding, eliminating, getting the bowels moved, moving out of it. Maybe you need some antifungals. Talk to your doctor about it, you know, or find a good doctor. Because you don't want to be trying to find itraconazole online. You know, some of these studies come out, and I always just worry that parents are like, oh, I'm going to buy it from India and then try it. I mean, the study was the itraconazole was very hard on the liver, and it can actually increase estrogen and over long-term use. I mean, short-term it's fine, but you know, just I love going on this podcast to kind of like clear up, you know, like don't do this, you know, because just talk cautionary tales, you know, because like you said, how do you know if you don't know? I mean, I only know because I got into this for my kids, so 10 years ago. So
it's very valuable. Your information is very valuable.
Oh, thanks, Ryan.
I always enjoy talking to you.
Thanks.
Is there anything else related to the GI that we haven't covered that you might think is could be informative?
No, I mean, well, we talked about the fungal markers, getting an oat, treating those, getting a stool test, treating their bacteria there. Clostridia, the C. diff and other Clostridia strains can be associated with a lot of aggression. So my last like kind of statement would be, if you see a kid that's just really aggressive, like hitting people, biting people, and especially if it seemed to happen overnight or it's just there's triggers, look at Clostridia. We do see that it seems to make kids very angry. And very depressed, either angry or depressed, but it causes that particular bug seems to cause mood issues. And so, you know, I think some parents, I just don't want you to think, well, this is my child. He just bites people. And in reality, there's a bad bug in their gut. So that you really got to look at. So there are several different types of dysbiosis. And again, we will treat them. And usually for the C. diff, we do use antibiotics. Because you really got to get rid of them. It's a spore forming bacteria. So that means that, you know, when you kill the kind of adult form of it, it'll form a little spore and just hang out there. It'll go inactive, but it'll just wait and it'll just sit there and then, you know, basically wait for it to bloom again. So it forms these little, it just kind of seeds itself in there and it doesn't want to go away. So you have to treat it usually for several weeks. Sometimes you have to do several rounds. Give it with an anti-biofilm agent. I mean, there's ways to treat it, but it is a difficult to treat bug. But treating it, you know, my son had it for a while at 4 and we were going through cycles. And yeah, he was just really grumpy, like really grumpy. And now he's just happy as a clam. So, I mean, we finally got his gut on better track. And I really pushed the second thing about the gut stuff I'd like to say is just that, in general, I try and push a lot of good bacteria. And there's some, you know, some practitioners say, well, this is going to increase, you know, serotonin, or this is going to cause a dysbiosis in and of itself. But, and that's valid. I mean, I think there's room for discussion, but I got tired of treating with my kids with antibiotics. Like we were doing these cycles of like, I'd treat them with antibiotics and then they'd have opportunistic infections and then they get fungusy and oh my God, it was this cycle. So, I started just drowning them in probiotics basically. And I'd rotate them and give them different ones. And we do some kombuchas and I do some like this Bio-K that's an active probiotic, like gut shot. We do capsules, different strains. I've tried all different strains and, you know, I find that actually helps them more long-term. Like now we don't need as much antibiotics. Like, so I try and push good bacteria versus killing when I can for the long-term.
Okay.
So in general, that's all.
Okay. I always heard that, anytime you're doing antibiotics, you should do a probiotic as well. I don't know if there's any truth to that, but the source of it is this very, he's very good. So
yeah.
I kind of believe him.
Yeah, no, yeah, I that's in general a good rule of thumb.
Okay.
Because again, the gut knows what to do. I mean, we've had, if you have enough good bacteria, they actually produce, it's really fascinating science. They produce a ton of antimicrobial compounds that kill other bad bacteria, and they reduce inflammation, and they increase motility, they increase butyrate that fuels the gut. So like, if you have enough good bacteria, it will crowd out the bad. It really will fight the bad for you. So these kids, a lot of times, they just don't have enough good. And I see it all the time when we test them. They're missing lactobacillus. They're missing bifido. They're missing key E. coli strains that are normally found in the gut. And then they get these dysbioses. So, you know, that instead of treating the gut bugs, when we increase treating the bad bugs, we give good bugs is always the goal if we can.
Yeah, yeah, okay. It's incredible information.
Yeah.
Very, a lot of good takeaways so far. So you want to pivot over to the telepathy tapes?
Oh, I don't know really what I want to say about it. I just wanted to talk to you about it because I just think it's fascinating. And it sparks my interest so much. And I don't know even how to wrap my mind around it. Like, I want to get into research regarding it. I wish, and I'm putting it out there in the universe. Because I love working with the autism population, and I really would love to try and, you know, understand, you know, like I said, I've come up with all these wacky theories. Like, we know that kids, studies have shown that in a lot of meta-analysis of these huge, you know, populations, copper dominance is huge in the autism spectrum population. So a lot of these kids have copper excess, like probably most. It's one of the number one metabolic markers associated with autism. So, I mean, maybe I'm thinking, okay, copper, what do we know about copper? I mean, we know a lot of things about the metabolism, but like, what if they're little conductors? What if they're somehow generating, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, drawing electricity, drawing some kind of magnetism. I mean, I don't understand it. I know copper's not magnets per se, but you know, maybe the metallopathies that we see in autism contribute to these skills that they have. Again, I start going down rabbit holes. We know that a lot of them have a lot of fungal overgrowth in their gut and sometimes in their sinuses and things. I mean, maybe it's more like the psilocybin deal. Like, maybe they're connected to some mycelium network because they have a lot of fungus growing in their gut, you know, and maybe they're getting knowledge that way. I mean, like, these are the things I contemplate at night, you know, and like when we talked about, maybe it's just because certain parts of their brain are extra active more than the normal brain, you know, like we, I think we mentioned last time that Dr. Amen, you know, with his spec scans that he looks at the brain, calls autism the brain on fire, in the sense that it's just hyperactive more than any other brain scans that in a population he finds. So maybe it's just the activation of the brain in a, I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts on it? I'd love to hear what you think.
The first time I really got into telepathy was from a Rick Rubin podcast.
And yeah. It was
a very valuable neurosurgeon and a neurobiologist from Stanford on it. And they talked about this. And this is where I found out that, well, telepathy has been published in well-respected journals. It's not like it's something new. And this was before the telepathy tapes came out. They were talking about water and quantum coherence and how water can signal and communicate distal without like axonal connections.
Okay.
And it's water that's doing this.
Okay.
And the neurosurgeon mentioned that there's a guy named Del Gushy or something like that. Del Gushy.
Yeah.
And he took vibrations of water and he could replicate the DNA exactly from across from US to Europe. So I'm thinking like with autism, because there is this dysfunction and it's the process of like the sensory and this, the movement of electricity is off.
Yeah.
It's like so wound up because of the bad connections. I'm wondering if it's just the sensory processing and just being aware of the environment is so accelerated here because of there's no proper distal connections being how we would sensory process, sensory perception processing, how it's just one connection to the other. If they can just do this because of what you were mentioning about how it's just that brain on fire, essentially.
Yeah, right.
And then the water vibrations happening at like local areas that aren't allowed to connect properly. I don't know if there's too much going on or if it's just the same amount. Let's just say as a whole, you're processing this energy. If the autistic person with telepathy is just bound at one local area, and that allows this recruiting of different connections and with the environment instead of that overall whole electrical like capacitor here being just moved like normally through axons.
Yeah.
I don't know, but that's what I think about whenever I think about telepathy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, water is that's an interesting theory. Just, I mean, we hear a lot of people that talk about, oh, I got this idea in the shower or that normal people kind of get more intuition from being in water. I don't know. I mean, definitely it could be the hyperfocus in the brain. Like you said, you know, we've known when people lose other senses, right? Like if you're blind and you have kind of this hyper sensory hearing, you know, I mean, you know, bats, for example, obviously it's not humans, but they have echolocation and they may have different organ receptors. I'm not sure, but nevertheless, even in humans, we know that people that lose senses will have extra sensitive other senses. So, you know, maybe it is the lack of speech that allows their mind to calm, you know, in a sense that they're focused on certain areas of their brain that the rest of us are just kind of running around in our frontal lobe, pay the bills. Okay. Mm-hmm. Make lunch, you know, and they're just like not using that part. And they're focused on, you know, this extra part.
Yeah. There's some areas known with autism, postmortem studies and whatever that the areas related for, or that do sensory integration is very abnormal.
Yes.
These areas that, you know, that takes multiple senses, you know, and makes sense of them and goes off and recruits other distal connections through the brain. These areas are bad in autism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would love to get involved. If you ever hear anything, Ryan, any kind of studies or anybody working on it or anything, like, just let me know, because I'd love to somehow jump in and get involved.
I would like to see video footage of it so I can really see, you know, it's hard for me to listen to the telepathy tapes because I can't see it. So
I guess you can go on the website or I guess they do have it for viewing. I think you have to pay for it.
Do they? I haven't really searched for it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's like, I know that she mentions it sometime, so I'd have to do a Google search, but there are videos like associated with the testing. But I looked on the website and I think you had to pay for it. And that's unfortunately where I stopped. So, but anyway, that's my two cents. And did I cover all your questions?
Yeah, I think so. It was a very fantastic exploration through the GI.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, there's, you know, these are just kind of baselines, but definitely I appreciate you having me on. I really love educating just people. And I really want everyone to know. I want everyone to know what I know. I wish I could just like transplant my knowledge just because, you know, because it took me 10 years to get here. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could just download it because, so I'm happy to share it because, you know, there's so many things that there are, you know, some aha moments. I know I say it on every podcast of yours, but there is a lot of hope and there are things you can do. And so I always try and translate, you know, that message. Just try it, do something, find somebody. If you're feeling inspired, if you have a gut feeling, like, I don't know, I had a parent that came to me. He's like, I think it's metals. I think my son's lead toxic. And I'm like, why do you think that? And he's like, I don't know. And so we did a test. We did a chelation challenge test because he was right. The kid's lead was like 54 times the upper limit. I'm like, wow, your kid is actually full of lead. Like, so if you have this intuition about your child, like, I think it's this, it's certainly worth investigating. I humor everybody. Like, yeah, I assume everything that everybody tells me is true. And then I kind of work backwards. And then I'm like, well, it doesn't look like this at all. It's actually this. But we always investigate it. So follow your gut. I've done that several times with my kids. And you know, like half the time it's right. No, it's not always right. But
my parents. It allows you to see without any bias there. It allows you to kind of zoom out and take a look at the full picture, I think, whenever, you know, you're listening to these other people. Sometimes people have a hard time doing that, especially if you're like a specialist.
Yeah. I just trust parents' intuition and I think parents are deeply connected to their kids. Like, don't the telepathy tapes. Like, there's this deep connection. Yeah. And a lot of people, if you just kind of, like, most moms know, like, something's wrong, you know? I mean, when you're connected to your child and then I'm the objective party that says, okay, let's assume that's true. Let's look for it. Let's test for it, you know, because I don't ever, you know, you want to have objective data too. And so that's good. It validates what they know. And then we're moving forward with a good, solid plan. If I had tested this kid and we did a chelation and there was nothing, I'd be like, well, shoot, I don't think, you know, you may be off, you know, and I wouldn't proceed. I would say, you know, I don't think we should be doing this anymore. It doesn't seem appropriate necessarily. And you can argue that maybe we were using the wrong substances. You know, I have some parents like, oh, no, well, it's still in there. And that might be true, too. We're all living in a bubble. So maybe there was the wrong dose, you know, maybe the wrong test. But, you know, it just, that point is just we go down the road because a lot of times we find stuff. We do. Yeah. And that's like, oh, cool. Look at that.
Parents know so much. It's so fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me on again. I super appreciate you. And like I said, I just want to tell the listeners this: none of this is medical advice. I work at Rossignol Medical Center. Dr. Rossignol is my supervising doc there. And he always wants me to tell everybody, no, this is not medical advice. Talk to your doctor. But we're a great center. We have like three locations in the U.S. and, you know, we're seeing new patients. But if you just want to contact me, I'm on X. I have a website, personally, www.nicolerincon.com. You can contact me there as well. So yeah, I mean, I'm available and I'm open for any discussions and opportunities too for further research. Oh yeah. And the research. Yeah. We're always doing research at our clinic. So, I'm always looking for new research. Yeah. So,
yeah, I'm always looking forward to what your group's pushing out. Dr. Fry's coming on next week as well.
Oh, is he? Oh, great. Yeah. Wonderful.
He's your second one, too. I'm like so blessed that
nice. Your
here is so willing to come on and share. It's so fascinating to me. I'm so thankful.
He's a good guy. He's a wealth of knowledge. And he's the PhD, you know. He'll tell you all the nitty gritty about the science. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate him a lot.
Yeah. It's great work from your guys' group.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming on, Nicole.
Thanks, Ryan. Well, have a good week.
Yeah, you too.
Hopefully we'll chat soon again. Let me know.
Yeah, we'll have to. We must.
We'll figure out our next topic.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan.